this study assumes that we transform everything. But then it says, of course, we're not going to transform. There's always going to be some inequalities that even if we transform as well as we can, and let's assume we achieve a decarbonized world by 2050, how do we deal with these, like, in some cases, like, very, very substantive inflows of financial capital?
Hello, and welcome to Economics for Rebels, the podcast of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Up until recently, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered and the earth was finite. This rebellion must bring a major shift to economic thinking. Our podcast is dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations, in conversations with scientists, experts, activists, pushing for rapid and radical change for people and planet. Welcome to our podcast. I am your host, Alexandra Kovesh, and you are listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. There are huge inequalities in the world when it comes to releasing carbon into the atmosphere. Some countries have disproportionately contributed to the climate crisis and keep aggravating their climate debt. In the language of climate coloniality, these countries could owe reparation payments to low-emitting nations. But can we calculate who owes whom how much? And should we calculate it? Today's guest, Andrew Fenning, together with Jason Hickel, recently published a paper aiming to answer these questions. Andrew is currently Research and Data Analysis Lead at the Donut Economics Action Lab and a Visiting Research Fellow in the Sustainability Research Institute of the University of Leeds. His area of expertise include indicators of sustainability and well-being, links between resource use and social performance, donut economics, steady-state economy and degrowth. His latest research developed a procedure to quantify the level of compensation owed if all countries were to decarbonize by 2050, and found that even in this case, the global north would appropriate half of the global south's share in the process. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Sandra. Pleasure to be here.
In the last couple of episodes of Economics for Rebels, we covered topics like biodiversity compensation with Sofus Tuomgassen, decolonization with Roland Gam, and the absolute failure of decoupling environmental burdens from economic growth with Timothy Parikh. So your topic fits in quite well with these lines of thought. But before we start, I would like to address the elephant in the room, as this is quite a controversial topic in ecological economics. Does it make sense to put a price to overshooting your fair share of atmospheric appropriation? What if countries can pay it? What if countries can pay it with money that actually comes into being already in an unjust way?
Yeah, those are, well, first of all, that's a great lineup of people to be together with. So I'm grateful for that. But I think that it could make sense under the context, you know, under the set of assumptions that we laid out in this particular study, which raises all kinds of, you know, what if questions like this in practice. But I mean, what if countries can pay with money that comes into being already in an unjust way? I would argue that in the world that we live in, you know, money is coming into being in an unjust way. And if countries can pay it, this gets into, I think we need to dive into a bit of the details of what we did in this study, which we'll get to. But an important point to emphasize is that our study focuses only on compensation that is owed for atmospheric appropriation, assuming the world reaches net zero by 2050. So assuming that we actually achieve this decarbonization goal that keeps us, you know, living in a 1.5 degree world, and that these compensation costs that we lay out should be considered additional to broader questions, you know, about the costs of actually achieving that, you know, mitigating emissions at that hugely ambitious rate, or adapting, or the damages that are already baked into this 1.5 degree warmer world that we're shooting for. So our study, it's it's definitely not saying to over-emitting countries, like, pay up and you get to keep emitting, right? Like, that's not what we're saying at all. What we're saying is that even if you achieve these incredibly ambitious decarbonization plans that you have committed to under the Paris Agreement, they will come at a substantial cost to you. But on top of that, you should also compensate low-emitting countries who have to mitigate far more rapidly than would otherwise be required to balance out your historical excess and your responsibility for causing the climate crisis that we're living in.
Your study calculated the cumulative emissions from 1960 across 168 countries. Who are the biggest emitters?
So the biggest ones that came out are, I mean, in terms of historical cumulative emissions, are the United States, Russia, Germany, Japan, and the United Kingdom, where it came out as the top five over-emitter countries. But I think it's worth taking a step back and asking, you know, what did we do in this study? And by saying, you know, in order to allocate, you know, if we're speaking about fair shares and appropriating atmospheric, like, just for our listeners to lay out the logic of the study, was we started by recognizing that the planet's atmosphere is a commons, right? Like, it's a gift from nature that we argue everyone should be able to access equitably and sustainably. And we also know from climate science that there's only so much carbon that can be released into the atmosphere to achieve a given climate target, right? Like, we want to keep global warming to within 1.5 degrees, then there's only so much carbon that can be emitted. So starting from 1960, for example, that 1.5 degree carbon budget, it's equivalent to about 1.8 trillion tons of carbon dioxide. So with those 168 countries, we divided that total carbon budget across each one based on their population sizes. And we wanted to know how much each country has emitted in comparison to their fair shares historically, and also take a forward-looking approach that considered a scenario of, you know, business as usual. If we continue along this deeply destabilizing pathway that we're on with emissions. And we also critically wanted to know about what would occur if we lay out a scenario where all countries decarbonize from their current levels to net zero by 2050. And what we find with that is, well, that gives us, on the one hand, the cumulative emissions that we can compare countries with respect to ideas of a population-based fair share. And the results show that most global South countries are still well within their fair shares of the 1.5 degree budget. So if there are, you know, the top five over-emitters, like, were the ones that I listed earlier, then the top five low-emitting countries were India, Nigeria, Indonesia, Pakistan, and shoot, I can't remember the fifth one. but there's another large country who are, you know, essentially still well within their fair shares of this 1.5 degree carbon budget. But the global north as a whole, as a group, has already overshot its fair share by, you know, something like 2.5 times, which this is where we come into the idea that they're effectively appropriating other countries' fair shares of the atmospheric commons. So I think that's hopefully helps lay out the logic of the study.
Do you calculate this based on production or consumption? Does it make a difference?
So when you go back to 1960, and again, for the listeners, you mean consumption-based, like a footprint metric that accounts for international trade versus a production-based where it's more territorial, what are the emissions that occur exactly within a country? So all the way back to, we actually looked all the way back to 1850 in a parallel analysis, but footprint-based metrics, like consumption-based metrics, don't go back that far. So what we did was took an approach that tried to maximize the amount of consumption-based data that we could use. And we did that by combining territorial emissions data for the period until finally around 1970, for most countries, we were able to use consumption-based. So it's actually a mixture of the two. But for the earlier periods, well, since 1970 in most countries, it's a consumption-based approach.
Okay, so we roughly understand how you come to calculate how much countries have used or and overshot or undershot. But you have this net zero target for 2050, and still you have the projection that the global north would overshoot its collective share of the 1.5 carbon budget by a factor of 3. And your suggestion in the paper is that, therefore, they need to pay reparation to the undershooting countries. But how can you calculate how much they need to pay?
That is another, I mean, we offered one approach, I would say. So, of course, there are many, many different ways that you could be thinking about reparations or compensation from over-emitting countries of the global north to the global south and so on. So we offered this one, and it was based on really this notion that if all countries achieve net zero, decarbonize their economies by 2050, and as you said, the global north as a group would collectively overshoot their fair shares by a factor of 3. And that is, you know, you can't come back from that. That's like, you've overshot your fair share. And so the only way to, you know, the zero sum world of carbon budgets, the only way to make up for that is for others to essentially forego a certain amount to balance that difference. And I should state that at the global level, a really, really important point is that if we achieve this net zero pathway across all countries, the world actually will stay within the 1.5 degree carbon budget. And that's crucial to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. So I would say that this is something that we should really, really do. However, I think that it's just for trust and for buy-in and for, you know, we just need to acknowledge that this has very different impacts across countries based on whether they're historically over-emitting or whether they're foregoing in order to balance it. So how do we calculate it? Is we just took the excess emissions of all over-emitting countries. So we said, okay, how much have you emitted over this period? And what's your fair share? So subtract your fair share. And now you have a measure of excess emissions. And for those excess emissions, we took carbon prices, which are available from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, using scenarios that are consistent with 1.5 degrees warming. And so when we use those scenarios, there are estimates of carbon prices provided by the IPCC that we obtained. And we took those carbon prices and effectively, which are, you know, it's like a dollar value in dollar value per ton of carbon. And you can then multiply that by excess emissions for each country. And crucially, along these scenarios, in order to achieve 1.5 degrees, the carbon prices increase over time. And so we took that into account in the scenarios by saying, you know, as countries move towards this net zero pathway over 2050, we multiplied excess emissions by the increasing level of carbon prices to get there. And that gives it monetizes the value of excess emissions that over-emitting countries have emitted over the period. And that's how we calculate it.
Okay, so the main message to me is that even if the global north countries are saying, yes, we're going to make it, we're going to reach our goal, our net zero goal for 2050, they still need to take into account their historical responsibilities towards the global south. And if we wanted to pay that in monetary terms, we can find methodologies to do that, to calculate that. That's kind of my take from the message, because I'm pretty certain that methodologically we can go on forever debating whether this methodology is better than the other and how do we... It's just one way of doing it, but the main message is this. If there is political will to do it, let's do it. We can scientifically find one way of doing it. And this is kind of in line with what we were talking with Roland a couple of episodes ago. However, it's quite interesting to go back to where you think this money would come from. Because also in your paper, you point out that there are huge inequalities within societies as to who is using up the carbon budget. So if you kind of, you want taxpayers to pay for this in the global north, you might end up with situations like the Yellow Vest movement, where it's actually the inequalities within the society that can't handle the kind of the demands of sorting out climate problems. So I think it's a crucial question. Would it come from taxpayers? Would it come from large emitters? Is there any way we can suggest where it should come from?
I think that that's certainly a key part of the conversation if we're going to be talking about compensation. In this particular paper, we, besides gesturing towards, you know, the very much I have the view, and Jason, my co-author as well, recognizes that when it comes to liability to pay, that we must pay attention to these very large class inequalities, because responsibility for excess emissions has largely been held by the wealthiest classes, and they're the ones who wield, you know, very, very large disproportionate power over the types of decisions that we make at a societal level around production, around consumption, around national policy. And so because of that, I mean, there's all kinds of research going back probably a decade now or more, led by Oxfam, showing that the wealthiest, of course, are the wealthiest 10% are responsible for about 50% of the emissions, is the classic, it's now classic statistic that is often used. So I strongly agree with the view that the wealthiest classes should be the ones who would bear the costs of compensation. How to do so, of course, is something that was outside the scope of this article. One of the main things that we wanted to show was almost the scale of it. And so when I was talking about, you know, calculating the costs in just a moment ago, I didn't actually say what the amount was. So we ended up finding that based on a 1960 start date, it was nearly $200 trillion due from over-emitting countries for their excess emissions by 2050. And so that's over the whole period between now and 2050, which works out to something like around $6 trillion per year. And another part of the study, of course, was we proposed a compensation mechanism that would distribute those funds to low-emitting countries, but based on how much of their fair share is getting appropriated, right? So that if you're having a larger share appropriated in order to reach net zero by 2050, a majority of the global south countries in our sample actually were receiving more than 75% of their fair shares would be fully appropriated in order to achieve this. So very, very large share. So if you're getting a larger share, then you would be entitled to receive a larger compensation in this study. And similarly, those with a lower share, like some emerging and middle-income nations, for example, China, then they would likewise receive a smaller degree of compensation. So that just seems, I mean, when it comes to the purposes of this paper, it wasn't so much to work out the practical implementation. It was more to offer an approach that could potentially be used to allocate compensation, taking into account historical responsibilities, fully acknowledging that it leaves many, many practical implementation questions kind of unanswered. But I guess our hope was that it starts the conversation and actually grounds some numbers in the just the the massive scale of all of it. But I mean, when you ask where should this money come from, very shortly after we published our study, I remember seeing another finding from a report by the International Monetary Fund about the surge in subsidies that governments provide to support fossil fuels due to the price of energy crisis that has been occurring over the past year. And coincidentally, perhaps, they estimate fossil fuel subsidies are more than $6 trillion per year. And so I remember seeing that and thinking, well, you know, these numbers just seem too big to comprehend. But if you compare it to the level of support that governments are already providing to prop up and clean up the very sector causing the climate crisis, then arguably, you know, it's not such a big number.
I fully understand that these questions are of course not included in this paper, because one scientific paper cannot cover for every kind of philosophical question that's behind this. But I still feel that it's important to talk about these, because this is what puts the perspective of how to talk about these kind of issues into the right focus, I think. And so therefore, I think it's important to maybe not just on the basis of this paper, but generally talk about where this money should come from. And I think your answer that you found a similar figure was quite a useful one.
Yeah, but I would also add, I mean, given the audience here, is that ecological economics has a huge amount of expertise that can be offered around the types of policies that would avoid the outcomes gave rise to the Gilets Jaunes movement, as you know, the sustainable scale, just distribution, efficient allocation, in that order, right? So that the Gilets Jaunes arguably was a policy that addressed climate, you know, reducing emissions, climate, but it didn't take into account the equity side, the just distribution side. So you need to design policies that achieve multiple outcomes. And I mean, going back to my Herman Daly, it's very, very difficult to think of a policy that will hit two birds at once or three birds at once, right? You need separate instruments to deal with separate goals. And so I think that, you know, ecological economics has decades of understanding around how to avoid those types of things. And we can certainly offer those solutions in as many fora as possible. So,
and it's also a question of not just where the money comes from, but where the money goes to. And that's also something that we talked about with Roland. I believe that one of the gravest problems we have with reparations is that if we dump the money into the usual unjust setup of how money flows in our economy, in our global economy, then we might end up not helping those who need it. But again, it can end up where we definitely would not want it to end up, for example, in the hands of corrupt leaders in the global south. So that's also an interesting question when we talk about reparations. Can you see any ways to mitigate that? I mean, you mentioned a couple of ways how ecological economics can help us understand how we should come up with the money, but do you have any suggestions or do you see any ways how to mitigate the problem of how and where the money flows to?
Yeah, that's a great question. I can see it, you know, just a full spectrum of possibilities. But I would, on the one hand, almost the assumptions of our study are so strict that I almost feel like the assumption of actually decarbonizing our economies by 2050 almost entails a full transformation, to me, a full transformation of the global system as we have it. Like, I don't believe, and there's, you know, we all in ecological economics have seen there's virtually no empirical support for the idea that we can decouple our emissions and continue growing in the type of system that we have inherited from the 20th century. And so I almost see that achievement of, you know, a decarbonized economy by 2050 would imply a transformation of everything. And so that's one side of things that, of course, it's not just going to be supply side or technology. It's also going to be demand side. It's going to be changes in behavior and ideally rebalancing of the international system around, you know, providing greater global governance or providing greater, you know, just addressing unjust debts and the types of relationships that underpin our current unjust system would also, you know, be part of that transformation towards a decarbonized economy by 2050. And if we don't do that, then these compensation estimates, which are based on, you know, assume that we achieve the 1.5 degree goal, then they're not going to be valid then either. So that's one side is kind of saying, okay, we need to, this study assumes that we transform everything. But then it says, of course, we're not going to transform. There's always going to be some inequalities that even if we transform as well as we can, and let's assume we achieve a decarbonized world by 2050, how do we deal with these, like, in some cases, like very, very substantive inflows of financial capital into countries? Of course, if it's going to, like, there's a figure in the study that shows for sub-Saharan Africa, the under-emitting countries of sub-Saharan Africa, it's the per capita, the annual receipts would work out to, you know, more than 100% of the current level of GDP of those countries. So this is a huge inflow based on these results. So what would happen if we do that? So you could imagine, just even if it doesn't go into the hands of corrupt leaders, I could just imagine just a massive inflationary pressure that would, of course, devalue everything and wouldn't really help at all, because it would just raise the prices of everything to that value. So these are the dangers, of course, of any time that you transform something into a monetary metric. Then you're talking the language of money, and how can you make sure that it flows to where it's needed? And again, our purpose for this study was really to demonstrate the scale of what is owed. And I'm not sure how to work around ensuring that it doesn't go into the hands of corrupt leaders. Besides, of course, I mean, Roland had some very clear ideas that you make sure that it goes to collectives, that it goes to the commons, that it doesn't need to go only to the world governments. And this actually resonates with another piece of donut economics, right? The embedded economy recognizes the market and the state, but it also recognizes a crucial role of the commons, and it recognizes the role of the households, the care economy, and that actually all four of those realms of provisioning come together to provide the goods and services that we use throughout our day. And we flip through those roles and identities, it's like seamlessly throughout the course of a day. So I think that it's a complex question, but I think that there's certainly, once again, there's thinking in ecological economics that can help us to make sure, or, you know, to minimize, to mitigate as well as we can.
I tend to get into arguments with people who say that the global south presents ecological problems with overpopulation, while the global north presents ecological problems with the overconsumption. However, this debate is quite important in your study, because your methodology is based on per capita. And hence, any opponent, and I guess most mainstream economists, would actually argue that, well, India is an undershooter with a population of 1 billion, while the UK is an overshooter with a population of 67 million. So where's justice? Where's fairness? Do we need to tackle the population problem at the same time? And I'm not among those who think that we should shift the responsibility of the global north to the south through these kind of arguments. But nonetheless, I see this being raised, especially concerning to your suggestions and your papers. So do you see any way to diffuse this argument?
Yeah. When we're specifically talking about carbon budgets, it's kind of, in some ways, it can be a little bit simpler because the atmosphere is a shared global commons. And if you have the sense that each person would be entitled to an equitable share, then to me, it's quite clear that using a population-based approach makes sense because one person's emissions in one place, it becomes globally well mixed very quickly so that it actually is a global commons. So I guess this can be contrasted with most other ecological problems, right? Tend to be more localized in nature. But when it comes to carbon emissions, that's not so much a concern. So I would say that that's one part that, I mean, if we're speaking about emissions of people, then it makes sense to count all the people who are involved in this, regardless of where they may happen to have been born.
Well, I understand. I think that's quite reasonable that we see humanity as one. But I guess a lot of people would say, well, once we start dividing historical responsibilities up according to nations, then we're already dividing humanity up. So while the carbon budget should be for the whole population, then it you know, we aren't treating humanity as one anymore.
Yeah, and I just remembered a finding that came out due to our approach in particular, because we take this cumulative approach that looks at, like, when we allocate fair shares, of course, it matters the analysis period that you're looking at. So I mentioned earlier that we looked at 1850, our main analysis is 1960, and we also looked from 1992, the year the UNFCCC was kind of ratified or agreed upon. And when you take populations over those three periods, the shares to each population actually change slightly because of population dynamics. And so what we found that actually surprised me a little bit is because I tended to think that the further back that you go, you know, the more, if you go back to 1850, then you're taking into account, you're not letting global North countries get away with their previous emissions. So, you know, there's a level, if you start at 1992, you're effectively like forgiving past emissions. And that's true. But also the population dynamics almost has a little bit of a compensating effect because the share of the global population of global North countries has been declining because our populations are actually growing, less quickly or even stagnant or declining in some cases. And so actually the relative share, as you change the different analysis periods, gets smaller for global North countries. And that actually compensated a little bit for going back further in time, which was a surprising result for me because it didn't make sense a whole lot at first, but actually you need to take into account both population dynamics as well as historical emissions. And it's the two of them moving together that, you know, that effectively change things.
Thank you so much. I think it's an incredibly interesting concept, and it's rare that there are so many different philosophical questions behind, like, just, you know, looking at numbers, and I think hopefully we managed to cover a little part of them, and I'm sure we could come up with a lot more. So I'm extremely grateful for this conversation, and now, as we're coming to the end of our conversation, I'd ask you the question we ask all our guests, but you are the very first one who actually returned to our podcast for the second time. So we have already heard some of your rebellions. However, I still ask you if your rebellions have changed in the last 2 years. Have they? Or do you have new ones?
Wow, that's actually a really big honor for me to be. Yeah, thanks so much for that. So I went back and listened to myself last time, just kind of blabbering on about my rebellions against the idea that growth-based economics is legitimate, against labeling any country as developed, like I just refuse that, against the idea of activism as a narrow view of protesting on the streets when actually, you know, it's much, much broader, and against the view that someone's achievements could be seen solely based on their merit, without, you know, we need to rebel against this view that things are only merit-based, because we need to take into account there's massive unearned benefits and privileges that are given to people along racial and gender and colonial lines. So those are all still there, which is, you know, which is good, I guess, and also not so good because things haven't changed as much, but it's only been a couple of years. But I guess I could emphasize that I really started to focus my rebellion on almost what you just mentioned at the end there, on recognizing the contested nature of data, that data is not, you know, it's always political, and that it's not some objective truth. So it's recognizing that contested nature. I try very hard, because I work with and I engage with data. So one hand is to make very, very clear the assumptions and to be transparent and to make the findings as widely accessible as I can is one approach that I think to start recognizing this contested nature. And what I'm really, really gets me passionate or gets me fired up is to make this through data, to make this ecological economics worldview, which of course is also entering in the political and in the philosophical and in the contested nature of different worldviews. But how can we make this particular vision, which I think is the right one, but I mean, I'm biased, but how do we make this vision visible and compelling through imagery and through data visualizations? And again, how do we make that as widely accessible as we can, so that when people see these things, they just say, wow, that's of course that must be right. And so that's, I guess, or maybe not that must be right, but clearly the approach that we're taking now is not the right way. So I guess that's an emphasis that I would add.
Thank you so much. Many thanks to Andrew, and thanks to all of you for spending time with us. Stay tuned with us for our next episode. Bye, Andrew.
Bye, thanks.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.